The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yeah, Miriam McGillicuddy, lecturer in law at the Munster Technological University and solicitor in Tralee, is with us in on the line. Miriam, good morning to you. Good to talk to you again.
Good morning, Terry, and good morning, listeners.
Very good.
On this fair morning, let's
fair. We'll call it fair. We'll give it that much. Miriam, we're just talking, I suppose, we'll start with a couple of different queries that have come into us and ones that have been left over from the last time. A number of people getting in touch with us in relation to a number of issues. One in particular is a listener wants to know who is responsible for a tree that falls down during a storm on private land.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, and we discussed, I think it was last month, all about the obligations on landowners in relation to overhanging trees and how they, if they don't sort them out, the ESB could come in or the local authority could come in, and that the people are responsible for their trees overhanging the public road. But this is one where it's private land, and I suppose the listener is thinking, oh, if a tree maybe falls on someone who's crossing their land during a storm, are they liable? Now, strictly speaking, if they know the tree is dangerous or know the tree has some kind of defect in it, they could still be liable in negligence in relation to, you know, what's on their land. Now, I know what the listener is thinking is that, isn't it an act of God or a force majeure? And certainly that would be a defence you could use. I mean, if you've checked your trees and they all look okay and you've no suspicion that they're going to fall down in any shape or form, that's a defence in itself. And one could say that it's caused by the storm or the act of God or whatever. But at the same time, one needs to be careful where one has trees, shrubs, etc. It's important for landowners to check their land, check their trees, and if they see ones that are rotten and that there's a risk of them falling, whether on their own or with the help of wind, that they would need to take them down.
Could there be a different scenario, maybe here, maybe not, but in general, let's say if you've private landowners adjoining each other, the tree is in a boundary hedge or fence and it falls from one into the other?
That's right, and it might cause damage. And
but in terms of, let's say, even clearing up the tree, who, like, if it falls on the land of the person on one side, let's say, of the divide, is it their job to clean it up?
Yeah, and it depends on the boundary. If it's a joint party-party boundary, they would be jointly jointly responsible, and also in relation to the wood, they would be jointly entitled to the wood and the cutting up of the tree, I suppose, strictly speaking. And so that's an interesting one, Jerry. But usually you've a tree on one or other boundary, but obviously they can cause a nuisance if they're on one side belonging to one person and then they're encroaching on another person's boundary. I suppose it doesn't matter so much out the country, but certainly in towns and cities it can cause problems where one is dealing with a smaller plot and a big tree can cause ructions.
Okay, please ask Miriam, if a grandparent passes away and leaves the house to a grandchild, are there taxes on this if the children of the grandparents have passed away? Also, the grandchild is the next closest relation.
Yeah, that's a very interesting one, because if a parent leaves a property to a child, they have a large tax threshold. It's 335,000 can be left to them without gift or inheritance tax. But for a grandchild, it's much lower. Normally, it's 32,500. Now, on the Revenue website, and I've sent in an inquiry about this, and they've come back and said that, say, if a parent died before the grandparent dies, their grandchild could inherit at their tax threshold, at the higher tax threshold, but it's only up till they're 18. Now, I've sent,
while they're guardians, in effect.
Exactly, yeah. Yes, that is it to some extent. And 18 seems very low.
Very
because,
young, yeah.
Yeah, because the dependency usually age would go till 23 if in full-time education. Yeah. Now, I've sent another clarificatory inquiry into my inquiries on it, but it does, the answer I got previously was it's only under 18, which does seem to be a bit unfair. And it is something that would be worth the politicians lobbying on. You see, as a standard thing in most wills, we put in that if the child dies before the parent, leaving children them surviving, that those children would inherit their share. So I think it would be quite important that that if the child died before the grandparents, that the grandchildren should get that higher share, that higher threshold.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Speaking of
in fairness.
Mm-hmm. We have another question. Good morning, Jerry. Miriam, I've left my home worth €190,000 to my daughter in my will. Will she have to pay tax on this when I die?
No, because of the threshold we mentioned earlier on, €335,000 tax-free without going into tax. But interesting, the only taxes she might be liable for is if there's local property tax due on it, or if mom had gone into a home and there was monies, a charge on the house for the fair deal. And the fair deal can take up to 22.5%, 7.5% per annum, up to 22.5% of a home is capped at that after the person dies. So that's the only thing that might be an issue in the case down the line.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. All right. Another query coming in on the issue of citizenship. If I apply for citizenship, do I get my documents sent back to me when they have received the application, or do I have to wait for the 2 years?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, sending in the documents, they could hang on to them for a good period of time. What most people do now is they send in copies only of the documents. So they certify they get them certified to be two copies of the originals by a solicitor, and those documents are fine for the purposes of the citizenship application. If you did send in original documents, just to be on the safe side, it would be important to follow up with a letter asking for them back, basically, because you might need them fairly quickly, like a passport, etc. Yeah. So that would be the thing to do there.
Yeah, okay. And another query coming into us, nomination from a credit union was suggested by solicitor to put in the pot to be divided up between the others. Is this normal practice? I've already received that money from the credit union directly to me.
Yeah, I mean, this is a lovely anomaly that the credit unions have. They have nominations. So if one has a credit union account, one can nominate a person that would receive that money directly when that person dies. Often people do it so that there's ready cash available for funeral expenses and, you know, the day-to-day expenditure maybe on a house with their trusted loved one. But what it means is up to 23,000, that's the limit, will go to the person straight, and it doesn't go into the estate normally, legally.
Okay.
So it stays out of the estate. Now, the interesting thing about that years ago was that revenue used to pick up on it at all. But the new revenue forms very clearly ask, is there a nomination?
Yeah.
Direct question. So one is stuck with putting in and explaining that that is the case if there is a nomination. And also it becomes part of the gift the person got in terms of assessing their capital acquisition tax. But it is a lovely way of benefiting people, that nomination in the credit union, and enabling people to get ready cash, as they say, after a person dies. They might have to pay for things, a lot of things, after the person's death. So it's very helpful from that point of view as well. I remember years ago, remember hearing about a scenario where somebody had divorced and estranged from their ex-spouse, and they forgot completely that they'd nominated their ex-spouse in the credit union. So after their death, the ex-spouse inherited the nomination. So that's a warning to people to just maybe refresh their nominations and just remember that they've done it. Because again, I mean, the solicitor here was trying to maybe recommend that it might be put in the pot, but I mean, strictly speaking, the person legally doesn't have to do that. That would be a matter of voluntarily if they want to put it in the pot.
If a person is using a piece of ground for the last 50 years, can they be put out of it? I'd imagine this will depend on the lease, Miriam.
It depends on the lease.
If there is a lease,
I mean, there's no rental agreement in place, but if they had paid rent for the last 50 years, that's an acknowledgement that it's a lease. So they can't get squatter's title. So often people would be renting property on an ad hoc basis. But once the money flows into the landlord's account every year, that's evidence that it's a lease agreement. It's a verbal lease agreement. And it would be impossible, you know, it would not really be possible to get any squatter's title after that period of time. In relation to being put out of it then, any lease can be terminated on reasonable notice. Mm. I mean, if you've a set term in a written lease, you could have a lease for 5 years, which means 5, 10 years, which means you're in that property for that length of time. But if it's a verbal arrangement, really, you can be put out on reasonable notice.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Miriam, we're out of time. We're going to leave it there. My thanks to you for talking to us on the programme this morning.
Thank you, Gerry, and thank you, listeners.